Lecture 4, Basic Motives Underlying Behavior.
Many fundamental questions in psychology involve motivation. What motivates you to do the things you do, to behave the way you behave? For example, how motivated are you to spend lots of time with other people? Or are you motivated to mostly be left alone? How important is it for you to be approved of by other people? Or do you not care very much what other people think? To what extent are you motivated to achieve and to be successful? Are you motivated to be in charge? Or are you just as happy to sit back and let other people call the shots? Overall, are you more motivated to seek rewards? Or are you more motivated to avoid risks? When I use the word motive, I'm talking about an internal state that directs behavior either toward or away from specific goals or specific outcomes. Motives instigate and energize behavior, and they push and pull our behavior in particular directions. An important aspect of personality involves what people are motivated to do and what they are motivated to obtain as they go through life. Part of what makes you, you, and thus makes you different from a lot of other people, is wrapped up in your motives. So these differences in the strength of people's motives can be regarded as personality characteristics or traits. We can understand a great deal about what people do in a particular day by knowing how much they are motivated by particular things. Psychologists have studied many specific motives, ranging from basic biological needs, such as needs for food and water, to highly abstract motives, such as the motive to find meaning in life or to have an impact on the world. But the bulk of research on personality differences in motivation has focused on three motives in particular: the motive to interact with other people, what we usually call affiliation motivation, the motive to achieve and to be successful, achievement motivation, and the motive to influence and exert power over other people, which we call power motivation. This lecture will deal with these three basic motives, and we'll examine some other motives later on. I'm going to start with affiliation motivation, which involves the degree to which people desire to be with and interact with other people. People differ a great deal in how much they enjoy affiliating with others. You probably know some people who like to be with other people as often and as much as they possibly can. They not only enjoy social interactions, but they become unhappy when they can't have the amount of social contact they would like to have. And you probably know other people who are motivated to be with other people much less often. It's not that they necessarily dislike other people. They simply are not as drawn to interacting with other people just for the sake of interaction. They're content to spend much more time by themselves. And of course, because personality differences in affiliation motivation are normally distributed, most of us are somewhere in the middle. Now, on first glance, this might seem like extroversion. But we're talking here about the degree to which people are motivated to affiliate, and not the degree to which they actually interact with other people. Of course, people high in affiliation motivation do tend to be somewhat extroverted. But many people are highly motivated to affiliate, yet they hold back from interacting with others because they lack confidence or they're afraid of being rejected. For example, many shy people are highly motivated to affiliate with other people, but their social concerns deter them from actually interacting. We're talking here about the strength of people's internal motive to be with other people, which may or may not be manifested in their actual behavior. That being said, the general pattern is that people who are higher in affiliation motivation do spend more time interacting with and communicating with other people. They tend to have more social interactions in a given day, and their interactions tend to last longer. They're also more likely to visit friends, to call people on the phone, and to send letters, emails, and text messages than people who are lower in affiliation motivation. And when they're by themselves, people higher in affiliation motivation are more likely to wish that other people were around. And in fact, after a period of solitude, people high in affiliation motivation may go on a search to find someone to interact with. Even the shy people I mentioned earlier would like to be with other people, but they're often reluctant to actually seek other people out. And it's particularly distressing to be shy if you're high in affiliation motivation. Because people high in affiliation motivation are motivated to interact and form social connections with other people, they want other people to want to interact and form connections with them. They can't fulfill their desire for affiliation if other people don't want to interact with them. So they tend to be highly sensitive to other people's reactions and concerned with what other people think of them. People low in affiliation motivation are not indifferent to how they're viewed by others, but they are less concerned because they aren't as motivated to interact with other people anyway. Because they value social interaction so much, people higher in affiliation motivation tend to behave in ways that will lead other people to want to interact with them. So, for example, they're more agreeable, and they're more willing to go along with what other people want to do. And they prefer to avoid situations in which they must compete with other people, presumably because competition often makes interactions with other people more distant and tense. At very high levels, affiliation motivation tends to be associated with social insecurity and with dependency. People who are very highly motivated to affiliate with others sometimes seem a bit too clingy and dependent. They need people too much. People who are higher in affiliation motivation generally prefer to work with other people rather than to work alone. And interestingly, they prefer to work with other people who are also high in affiliation motivation. After all, if you really enjoy social interaction, it's not much fun to work with somebody who doesn't like to interact as much as you do. And if you're low in affiliation motivation, it's annoying to work with someone who wants to interact all the time. Things tend to go more smoothly when people work with others who are about their same level of affiliation motivation. This preference also plays out in close relationships, such as dating relationships, marriages, and other committed partnerships. Research shows that couples who are relatively matched in their level of affiliation motivation tend to have happier relationships. Not only do people like their partner to interact at the level at which they themselves feel comfortable, but as a couple, they're more likely to enjoy similar activities. If you're high in affiliation motivation, but your partner is low in affiliation motivation, you may be frustrated by your partner's lack of interest in socializing with other people. And if you're low in affiliation motivation, you may be frustrated by the fact that your partner always wants to go out socializing. So if you're single, you may want to keep all of this in mind as you meet new people who might become a serious partner. In any case, people who are low in affiliation motivation tend to behave differently from people who are high in that trait. And as a result, they tend to lead rather different kinds of lives. A second important motive on which people differ is achievement motivation, the motive to be competent and to perform at a high level, whether we're talking about professional success or doing well in school or being a successful athlete or whatever. To what extent is a person motivated to do things as well as possible in order to achieve and succeed? You can think of achievement motivation as the priority that people place on achievement relative to other motives that they might have. Among all of the things that are important to you, how important is achievement? Researchers have designed some pretty good measures of achievement motivation over the years, Some of these measures are self-report questionnaires with very straightforward questions that tap into the importance that a person places on achievement. Let me give you some examples of items. And to what extent would you say these statements are true of you? Other people see me as a very hard worker. Or, in my work, I always try to do more than what's expected. It doesn't really matter to me whether or not I become one of the best in my field. That would be low achievement motivation. I try to work just hard enough to get by. That's low achievement motivation too. I often set goals that are difficult to reach. That's high achievement motivation. Other measures of achievement motivation are projective tests, in which people are asked to tell a story about an ambiguous picture in which it's not at all clear what's actually happening in the scene. So, for example, imagine a picture in which a stern woman in a lab coat is watching a younger woman working with scientific equipment. And you're asked, what's happening here? Tell a story about this picture. Different people will tell stories with different themes. Perhaps a story about the social relationship between the people, or about control, or about criticism, or about boredom, or whatever. But people who are high in achievement motivation tend to tell more stories with themes about achievement and success than people low in achievement motivation. So over a series of 10 or 20 pictures, we can get a pretty good idea of who's high and who's low in achievement motivation. These projective tests also show us that people who are higher in achievement motivation tend to see achievement themes in ordinary daily events. As they go through life, they're more likely to see the world in terms of achievement. So, in an odd sort of way, people low versus high in achievement motivation actually see the world somewhat differently. Of course, like most traits, achievement motivation is normally distributed. Most people are moderate in achievement motivation. Achievement is important to them at times, but they balance their desire to achieve against other things in life, such as their family, their social life, leisure activities, and their health. At the high end of the distribution, though, some people put an exceptionally high value on achievement, so much so that it usually trumps other motives and goals. And at the low end are people who generally don't care how well they do or how successful they are. Other things are more important. Let me run through some of the characteristics that are associated with high versus low achievement motivation. The higher you are in achievement motivation, the more you will probably show each of these characteristics. First, people high in achievement motivation have a more energetic approach to their work, whether it's their job or schoolwork or practicing some skill they want to learn. They're hard workers, and they tend to stay on whatever task they're doing longer than people who are lower in achievement motivation. So people who are higher in achievement motivation tend to work more hours on the job or in school or wherever, because that's how one achieves. You do more than other people. People on the low end of the continuum tend to work just hard enough to get by. They certainly don't want to fail, but they aren't particularly motivated to do really well. People who are high in achievement motivation not only work more, but they also work at greater intensity, with more focus and energy. But they usually work harder and more intensely, mainly on tasks that have implications for achievement or accomplishment. They don't necessarily work harder when they do their laundry or go to the grocery store. To say it differently, people high in achievement motivation work harder only when they view the situation in terms of achievement. If achievement's not involved, when they're walking their dog or doing the dishes, they don't necessarily work harder than anybody else. Research shows that people with higher achievement motivation prefer to have a job in which they have a good deal of control over how well the job is done. For achievement-oriented people, it's not very motivating to work on a task that's so clear-cut or so mundane that one can't really achieve. And finally, and this one sometimes surprises people, people high in achievement motivation generally prefer tasks that are moderately difficult rather than very difficult. You might imagine that a person high in achievement motivation would want to tackle really difficult and challenging things, and they do, but only up to a point. There's a downside to taking on very challenging tasks. Your chance of succeeding is low, and people high in achievement motivation want to succeed. So when they have a choice, people high in achievement motivation prefer tasks that are right at the upper edge of their level of ability, but that they feel reasonably certain that they will eventually accomplish. They want tasks that are challenging, but doable. So does all of this hard work pay off? Are people who are motivated to achieve actually more successful than those who are less motivated to achieve? Absolutely. They do better in school, and they do better in jobs in which how hard they work contributes to success. They tend to attain higher status in their professions, and they tend to earn more money. But they don't do better in positions in which they can't achieve more by working harder. Achievement motivation is beneficial only when a person's success is based on effort. Where does this motive come from? Why are some people more motivated to achieve than other people are? Well, you might be surprised to know that there's a genetic component. In fact, about 40% of the variability that we see in how achievement-oriented different people are has some sort of genetic basis. We're not sure exactly what it is, but we know that it's partly inherited. You probably won't be surprised that achievement motivation is also affected by how children are raised. Parenting styles that stress self-control and that emphasize waiting for rewards, what we call delay of gratification, predict achievement motivation. An important part of achievement is making yourself stay on task even when you're not getting anything out of it at the moment. So anything parents do to increase children's self-control and delay of gratification is likely to increase achievement motivation. Achievement motivation is also predicted by the degree to which parents emphasize effort rather than ability when they praise and criticize their children. Bragging on children for how hard they work rather than for how smart they are is more likely to lead children to be motivated to work hard. And likewise, when children fail, addressing how much effort they expended rather than the fact they lacked ability is more likely to lead to high achievement motivation. As I said, having at least a certain amount of achievement motivation has benefits for people. But there are also downsides to being excessively achievement-oriented, serious downsides. It can kill you, literally. Back in the 1950s, two cardiologists who were studying the personality characteristics of people with heart disease found that a very high percentage of their heart patients displayed a particular sort of hard-driving, achievement-oriented personality. They called this the Type A personality. Type A involves being aggressively involved in a chronic, incessant struggle to achieve more and more in less and less time. So being type A involves very high achievement motivation, but it's achievement motivation gone wild. Type A people show all of the characteristics of achievement-oriented people I just described, but type A involves two additional features that make it a particularly stressful and dangerous kind of achievement motivation. First, type A people live with a chronic sense of time urgency. They feel that there's never enough time to get everything done. Now, of course, that's sometimes true. Many of our lives are pretty busy. But type A people structure their lives in such a way that they chronically experience time urgency, and they're always in a hurry. always feeling that you never have enough time to get everything done is very stressful, and it can interfere with the quality of life. Type A people eat faster and walk faster than other people. They even talk faster, and they often hurry other people along who are taking too long to make a point. Type A people are also more likely to multitask, to try to do more than one thing at once, in order to squeeze as much as they can into as little time as possible. Of course, most of us have periods when we feel that we don't have enough time, and some of us multitask now and then. But for most people, those times pass eventually. But type A people never, ever get caught up, because they keep piling more and more on their plates than they can handle. So they work at or near their maximum, whether or not they have deadlines. Type A people even estimate the passage of time differently. Studies have been conducted in which participants are asked to estimate the passage of a minute. If I said, "Start now and tell me when you think a minute is up," those of you who are type A would underestimate the length of a minute. One study showed that you would estimate a minute at about 52 seconds. You genuinely feel that time is passing more quickly than it actually is. Other people on average are pretty good at estimating the length of a minute. I suspect that many of you know exactly what I mean when I talk about time urgency. But I also know that many of you are thinking, "But I really do have too much to do. I really do need to hurry to get everything done in a day. I really do have to work at full bore all the time." And I don't doubt that that's true. But why do you have so much to do? For many of you, not all, but a good chunk, it's because you are so highly achievement-oriented that you've created a life that's filled with lots of work and many challenges. I know because I've been there. So you're motivated to do a great deal, and you're motivated to do it well, and you get a lot of pleasure from accomplishing so much. But it's often very, very stressful. In addition to time urgency, the second and most dangerous aspect of type A is chronic impatience and irritability, particularly impatience and irritability that comes from being slowed down. How do you react when things slow down your progress on whatever you're doing? The slow person ahead of you in the grocery store, the slow driver, the computer that takes too long to boot up, the person who wastes your time by jabbering on about nothing, being put on hold when you make a phone call. And are you frustrated by wasting time on routine tasks like paying the bills, doing the laundry, or washing the dishes? Of course, nobody likes to be slowed down or waste time. The question is, how strongly do you react when these things happen? Can you feel your blood pressure skyrocket? Do you get really frustrated and angry? Do you sometimes feel like you're going to lose it when you get slowed down? When you're highly motivated to achieve, anything that slows down your progress, whether it's other people or just boring, time-wasting tasks, is irritating, if not maddening. And it appears that having regular, strong reactions to being slowed down is the most dangerous aspect of being type A, the feature that increases the likelihood of heart disease and cardiac arrest. So the trick is figuring out how to be high in achievement motivation without falling off the cliff into being type A. The third basic motive that I want to talk about is power motivation, which involves the degree to which people are motivated to influence and control other people. The use of the term power in this context connotes a more heavy-handed motive than the construct actually involves. Although domineering, controlling people are certainly high in power motivation, some people who are high in power motivation exercise their influence in less dominant ways. So don't think of power motivation as simply dominance. The central question is, How much do you like to influence or control the actions of other people? How much do you like to be in charge? Sample items from measures of power motivation are things like, I enjoy being a leader. I like to be in charge. I would like to be an executive with power over others. Or, at the other end of the continuum, people who are low in power motivation endorse statements such as, in a group, I would rather be a follower than the leader. I don't like to have the responsibility for directing the work of other people. I feel uneasy when I have to tell other people what to do. You can identify people who are high in power motivation by the paths they take in life. For example, they belong to more groups and organizations because joining groups offers opportunities to influence other people. And they hold more offices in those organizations. And even when they're not in a formal position of authority in a group or organization, other group members rate people higher in power motivation as having higher status and influence in the group. Power-motivated people tend to end up in careers in which they are in charge of things. Not surprisingly, they're more likely to be managers and CEOs and school principals and other head honchos. But they're also more likely to be school teachers and members of the clergy because those jobs also involve influencing other people. When they're in a position of power, people high in power motivation tend to use a more directive style of leadership. They like to decide what the group should do and then convince everybody to go along. Of course, there are other effective leadership styles that involve a more inclusive and democratic approach, but people who are high in power motivation want to call the shots. Now, interestingly, this more directive leadership style is not necessarily more effective. When a leader is high in power motivation, fewer ideas get discussed within the group, and other group members feel less free to offer suggestions and concerns. So leaders high in power motivation sometimes cut themselves off from input from other people and end up being less effective than if they had exerted less influence over group decisions. For most characteristics, people tend to prefer others who are somewhat similar to them. When it comes to personality, values, and attitudes, people tend to associate with those who are most like them. But this preference for similarity does not generally apply to people high in power motivation. People who are high in power motivation tend to have friends who are lower in power motivation than they are. In marriages, power-motivated men have a preference for partners who are less motivated by power than they are. And there's also evidence that employers who are high in power motivation prefer to have employees who are lower. One interesting study even investigated the power motivation of presidents of the United States. Now, obviously, anybody who ends up as president is probably pretty high in power motivation. But even so, presidents differ in the degree to which they are motivated by a desire for power. The researchers developed a way to assess presidents' power motivation by analyzing the themes in the inaugural speeches of all elected presidents. How much did the new president stress themes of power and control? The results showed that presidents who scored higher in power motivation were more likely to get the country into a war than those who were lower, and they were less likely to negotiate with rival countries or to sign arms treaties. However, power-motivated presidents were also more likely to make great decisions, as judged by recognized presidential historians. So exerting power can lead to both good and bad outcomes. A good deal of research has examined the question of whether men and women differ in power motivation. Of course, the stereotype is that men are more interested in power than women are. But is that true? Now, keep in mind that the word power is a bit misleading here. So what we want to know is whether men and women differ in how much they want to influence and control other people, to get other people to do things the way they want them to. And when you think of it that way, it becomes pretty clear that men and women don't differ in power motivation on average. Because of social norms, men and women may differ in the contexts in which they want to have influence, and men and women may be socialized to exercise power and influence differently. But in terms of the desire to influence other people overall, there's no overall difference in power motivation between men and women. We've discussed personality differences in only three basic motives in this lecture, and we'll be talking about others later on. But we can understand a great deal about people by knowing they're standing on only these three motives: the strength of people's motives for affiliation, achievement, and power play an important role in fashioning their personality and account for a good deal of variation in how people tend to behave.